You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Monday, June 28th, 2010, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
It was July 3rd, 1844, when the last pair of great auks were killed.
Why'd they kill them?
They were hungry. I suppose, you know, humans tend to do these
pretty
things
good excuse.
Without good reason.
Right. They were great auks?
Great auks was a large flightless alcid. That's like a penguin.
Yeah.
It looks like a penguin, yeah.
Impennis is the Latin.
Did they both die at the same second?
Yeah, that's a good question, Jay. I was wondering.
Maybe it was a murder-suicide.
How do they know
we're
for
the last
sure,
ones? Let's
really,
kill ourselves.
That these are the last ones.
Maybe they killed one and then the other one died of a broken heart.
Yeah.
And then a red fern grew from the grave. That happens.
They pinpointed it to July 3rd, 1844 in Iceland.
Oh, wait. So this is, we were joking, but it's true. They both did die on the same day.
Yes.
Wow.
But to be clear, even though these may look a little bit like penguins, they were not penguins. They were not in the same family even, or even order of birds as penguins were, completely different.
It's not. I mean, if you look at it.
Although you said it was in Iceland?
Yeah.
I know nothing about
Iceland,
auks.
Actually, they were in Scotland as well.
Wait, I just looked auks up on Wikipedia and they still exist. Oh, but great auk. And they are superficially similar to penguins.
Yeah, so scientists started paying attention in the mid-1500s. They realized that these were disappearing, becoming fewer and fewer.
Endangered, almost.
There were actually some early environmental laws to prevent, to try to save the species, but it wasn't enough. Humans hunted them for their skins and their eggs.
I hope they're happy now.
That was July 3rd. Oh, and happy birthday, Bob.
Oh,
it's Bob's
thanks.
Birthday?
July 4th.
No, it is tomorrow.
July 4th.
As we record this,
yes.
It's tomorrow.
Wait, today's... Oh, don't
as
confuse
the
me
day after
your,
the podcast goes up, right?
We could all be dead by then. Don't,
that's right.
Let's not pretend
well,
that
then
it's,
it doesn't... If we're all dead, then this podcast...
Because that would be really awkward.
If we're all dead, who's
talking about how... Like, oh, look, tomorrow's July 4th, but they all died July 2nd. Don't do that.
I'm so confused.
How old are you now, Bob? 39 again?
No, I will be 17,155 days.
Congratulations. So, Rebecca, tell us about the whooping cough epidemic in California.
Yeah, there's a whooping cough epidemic in California.
Oh, I'm so glad you told us about that.
The way it works is that apparently whooping cough, which is also known as pertussis, I believe, right?
Yes, pertussis.
Yeah.
Yes, it ebbs and flows, generally in about like 5 year periods, 2 to 5 years. And it's been about 5 years since the previous peak. And now California is hitting the next peak, but that peak does happen to be on track to be the biggest epidemic they've had in 50 years. It's tough to pinpoint exactly what the cause is, but it's looking like the problem is, well, I mean, first of all, the problem is low vaccination rates, obviously. As to whether or not those are being caused by immigration or what I think is a bit more likely is just the fact that people aren't vaccinating. Not just that they're not vaccinating their kids, like when we hear about Jenny McCarthy and that group, but adults aren't being vaccinated. Whooping cough is one of the vaccinations that you get when you're a baby and also you have to get it again when you're a teenager. Well, I think again when you're 3 or 4 and then again when you're a teenager. And then you should have updated shots every 10 years, I think, right now. So, but a lot of adults don't think about it. The problem is that when babies come into contact with whooping cough, it's very serious. It's a very serious problem. Adults could have it and not even notice it, but it tends to be fatal in babies, particularly babies under 2 months old. And of course, babies under 2 months old are not old enough to be vaccinated yet. So they rely on what we call herd immunity, which we've talked about quite a bit on this podcast. Herd immunity is the idea that you get everybody, as many people as you can, vaccinated, and it helps protect the people who we can't get vaccinated, people who for some reason aren't able to be vaccinated or too young to be vaccinated. But unfortunately, herd immunity is affected when we don't have herd immunity in California right now.
If you look at just the raw numbers for the whole state, it's above herd immunity levels, which is only about, you only need about 90% or so.
Well, no, that's not true. In California, about 44% of teenagers had their pertussis booster, which is higher than the national average. The national average is about 41%, but it's still much lower than many other states where teens are required to get their booster shot. In California, it's one of, I think maybe 10 states, I could be wrong on that exact number, 11 maybe, states that don't require teenagers to get their pertussis booster shots. And so because of that, those states have much worse vaccination rates when it comes to pertussis. And so it leaves the door open for epidemics like this. And unfortunately, it's taking a toll. There have already been 5 children who have died since mid-June, I believe, so from this very epidemic. And it's going to continue unless we get more people, you know, adults and teenagers particularly, getting their booster shots, being vaccinated, so we can build up that herd immunity.
Yeah, but the other point I was going to make is that even if you look at, like, for children, the overall vaccination rates, even when they exceed herd immunity, the problem is that you have pockets that fall below herd immunity. So, for example, there are 175 schools where the objectors to the people who apply for an exception to vaccination are 20% or more, and some schools have 70% or more of people basically applying to not have to get the vaccine. So if you look at the numbers for the whole state, even for kids where it's high because it's required, you still got these pockets of below herd immunity, and that's where these epidemics tend to get started and promulgate.
Right.
Yeah, then they break out into the general population, or again they attack the vulnerable populations, like in whooping cough, the big one, as you mentioned, is kids, because they get their first vaccine at 3 months, but the full sequence isn't completed until 6 months. So really, kids less than 6 months old are partially or completely vulnerable to the disease. So, but with this particular epidemic, we don't have the epidemiology yet to know how much of it is spreading through unvaccinated populations versus Hispanics, which actually it tends to be a very vulnerable population in California, versus the vaccinated general population. But I wouldn't be surprised if these pockets of low vaccination rates are not largely responsible.
Yeah, and I mean, even though pertussis isn't one of the vaccinations that people like Jenny McCarthy accuse of causing autism, those campaigns, those quote-unquote safe vaccine campaigns that are really anti-vaccination campaigns, really have their effect, because they do make people frightened of all vaccines, including things that they're not even specifically targeting as causing autism. And, you know, Australia has seen this problem firsthand, where they had a very high profile death of a child from pertussis last year. And that was, I think, attributed to the misinformation that's being spread about vaccinating your children. So
yeah.
I think no matter what, you know, people, adults need to be educated, particularly that these vaccinations are safe and they're effective. And there's really no reason why whooping cough should be at this stage, at an epidemic stage in California. It should be gone. But, you know, and it can be, so long as we just get vaccinated.
Right. But, you know, a lot of people think that we really won't turn the corner against, you know, the anti-vaccination propaganda until we start to see the return of epidemics like this.
I understand that. It's just, that's such a sad idea to me, because what that says is that this is going to happen for the rest of humanity's existence, where they'll, you know, solve a problem, and once it's out of sight, it's out of mind, and people will stop protecting themselves against these diseases, and they'll come back, and then everybody will figure it out, and they'll start protecting themselves again, and then they'll die out. It's very pessimistic because, yeah, but you know, that's, and not, that's not to say that it's wrong, but.
Yeah, but you just described exactly what happens historically, just with many things. You know, it is out of sight, out of mind. When risks get reduced to a certain level, people start forgetting about it and protecting against it.
Yep.
Well, Jay, you're going to tell us about a whaling film that is being criticized for being a deceptive piece of propaganda.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's 100% sure whether or not the video is legit or not. But a Norwegian animal welfare and anti-whaling organization released this video. They shot it on May 23rd, 2010, of a mink whale hunt in northern Norway off the Lofoten Islands. I probably pronounced that wrong. Those are islands that are off the northern coast of Norway. So they claim the video shows a whaling ship fire a harpoon at a mink whale, which you can clearly see them doing in the video. And the question is whether or not the whale was actually injured or not in the initial harpoon firing, okay? And then they said 2 hours later, the same ship shot another harpoon that killed the whale that it was shooting at. And they think that it was the same whale and that the whale had cruelly been injured swimming around for 2 hours. And that's really what the whole issue is surrounding this particular video. So the reason why that they're doing this, the reason why that the animal welfare and anti-whaling organization is doing this, is they want to show that, you know, there is still cruel whaling procedures being done, number one. And number two, that even if that wasn't the whale, they are very much trying to land it home that a moving boat is not 100% sure of hitting a whale at the right spot to kill it. So that, they, you know, that injuring the whales is probably a lot more common than these organizations ever claim. So at the International Whaling Commission, the Norwegian delegation stated that the film was edited to misrepresent the facts and that it was a scam. And a leading veterinarian who developed more humane harpoons to kill whales faster stated that the footage doesn't show the whale get hit from the first harpoon and that the video was misleadingly edited to further their agenda. So there's this question of whether or not, you know, they just smartly edited this film with a good voiceover, like telling about what's going on, but that's not really what's taking place. And, you know, I'm not an expert in any of this, but, you know, from looking at it, you can tell that they shoot something, but you can't tell where it hits. Like, I can't tell. It's not crystal clear, you know, where it hits. It doesn't really seem to be that much activity going on. It's nothing very obvious. I mean, I've seen much more horrible video than this that really shows what's going on. This just looks like a splash in the water, you know? So later in that same meeting, the International Whaling Commission of Greenland petitioned to add 10 more whales to their total annual hunt that they can do per year. They're allowed to hunt specific numbers of specific types of whales. And they claim that they have a nutritional and cultural need to the hunting of these whales. And I found that very interesting. And I thought that there was commercial use for whale blubber. Like I know, like we said before a few episodes ago, that they use whale fat in the Hubble telescope to grease the machine, you know, grease some of the mechanisms, and maybe it's because of a temperature thing or some certain properties that it has. But there are people out there that are still claiming that there is a need to eat whales, and you know that's a point for them to still be allowed to do it.
Yeah, it's interesting because there's a lot of concern politically among certain groups for the rights of indigenous people. And at the same time, for you know, the rights of whales, which are increasingly recognized as a very, you know, sophisticated mammal, and they absolutely collide in this issue of indigenous people using traditional, you know, methods of whaling for subsistence, you know, to eat, and how do you resolve that conflict? I mean, that comes up in other contexts as well, where you basically have an environmental threat from an indigenous people,
yeah,
right? And where does that balance shake out?
It's basically just a moral issue. Which do you value more? You know,
right.
A culture's right to their heritage, or you know, an intelligent species, you know, right to not suffer unduly. Personally, I come down on the whale's side, but that's just because I know that the second they evolve thumbs, they're going to murder us all. I'd like to stay on their good side. But
so listen to this quote from this guy's named Lee Fontaine, and he's the head of the Organization of Fishermen and Hunters in Greenland. He said, Whaling and our right to use humpback whales has also been an important part of our marine traditional food source from the time immemorial and has been and still is an important resource along the large part of our coastline and is part of our cultural heritage. So he says it all in one sentence.
Yeah.
I don't, you know, Rebecca, I agree with you. Like, I don't think it's okay to hunt these animals. I don't think it's okay. I think there's a lot of very rational reasons why we should not hunt whales. One of them, they are highly intelligent. Two, they absolutely have been in the past an endangered species. I'm sure that there are still some whale populations out there that are suffering from overhunting. But there's no real reason to farm these animals other than tradition. I don't believe that they have any nutritional requirements from hunting whale. I just think it's ridiculous.
And you know, I know that a lot of other indigenous populations have adapted their techniques, you know, maybe not in this particular instance, but it's not to say there's really no reason why they can't adapt, why they can't change with the times.
Yeah, can't they eat baby seals instead?
Right. Right. Look at how easy they are to club.
Hook them up.
Right.
but to learn to use modern techniques to kill whales, to at least make it, you know, less horrific to the actual animal, to be more humane about it.
This organization definitely believes in that, and they, like I said, they had a veterinarian, you know, who worked on more humane harpooning. But their point was that even with the advancements in harpooning technology, it's still not 100% that they're going to humanely shoot the animal. Like, they could miss the, you know, think about if the boat swells 2 or 3 feet at the wrong time or whatever, you know, it isn't like shooting a gun where you have a much greater chance of accuracy as your skill goes up. Like, there's still a huge factor in there.
Never a guarantee, you know. Yeah, when you're shooting an animal to kill it, there's never a guarantee that it's going to be a clean kill, right? It's not like you're in a controlled environment in a slaughterhouse or something. I agree with Rebecca. On one level, we just have to decide, are these animals above or below the line? Right? Are they above the line where we say, "Listen, it's not ethical to hunt and kill them, regardless of the context or the circumstance or how humane it is"? That's where I fall with whales. It's also like chimpanzees and gorillas. It's just certain animals that are above the line, and that's it. But you know, I certainly could see the perspective of indigenous people where they say, "Okay, well, so you completely ravaged and destroyed the environment, but now that you've realized how horrible that is, you want us to stop this little tiny sliver that we're doing, and this is all we have." You can kind of see their perspective. Unfortunately, we have to say, "Well, yeah, sorry about that. We did kind of ravage the earth, and now we have to." that does put limits on what we all can do.
Ignore that oil spill. That's nothing.
Well, yeah, right, exactly. I mean, we're not in exactly a moral position where we could start dictating things to indigenous cultures.
Which is why I think that it shouldn't be us versus them. I think that this is the sort of thing that we should talk about as a species,
you know,
and decide what our goals are. And not everybody's going to agree.
I don't go with that.
But they see it that way. But they see it that way.
Oh, okay.
That's my point. I'm saying that's how they see it. And from their point of view, I mean, if you're a tribe living in South America that is, needs to farm to live, and people are telling you, "Oh, you can't cut down a rainforest to farm and grow food to eat," you know,
what rainforest? This is a jungle.
Well, that's Steve. It's a good point that you bring up. You know, like, we can't just come and say, "Okay, stop that." You know, like, we have to help anyone that we're limiting a food source with, any culture or any community, sure.
Right.
I mean, I'm sorry that I actually gave humanity credit that was already part of the equation. Maybe it isn't, which is ridiculous.
No, we should absolutely make every accommodation to compensate them for the fact that we're not going to let them kill whales anymore or cut down the rainforest or whatever it is that they're doing that they basically don't have the luxury to do anymore because we screwed things up, right?
You know, my goal that I'd love to see humanity get to is that, you know, we can manufacture meat in the laboratory and people don't have to kill animals at all anymore. I mean, isn't that a great goal to get to
it
at
is.
Some point?
It is, Jay, and people are actually working on that. And I think we'll reach that point in the not too distant future, and it'll be a choice. People will have the choice whether to have, you know, real meat or this artificial meat that, I don't see any reason why ultimately it can't be, you know, just as good as or even in some ways even superior to the meat that we all eat.
Of course, pork is excluded. I'm sure they couldn't match bacon. You know, everybody knows bacon. They'd never, Rebecca, be able to match the flavor of bacon.
Replicated bacon?
We're still waiting on that magical bacon that you promised to eat 50 pounds of or whatever way back in the day.
I remember. I know, but you don't. If you bring it, I'll eat it.
I also read a science fiction story. I believe this was some Star Trek novel where they were talking about the same issue about, you know, like what do you do when an indigenous culture's tradition is hunting and killing an endangered species? And their solution was to make like an animatronic version of the animal that you can hunt and kill.
Over
quote
and over.
Unquote kill, yeah, but it's just a robot.
Along the same lines, what do you do when an indigenous species is hunting and killing humans, like in the new Predators movie with Adrian Brody and Topher Grace?
Yeah, what do you do then, Steve?
What do you do?
Yeah, but they're aliens,
Topher.
Man.
Did we get
the Predators
for that endorsement?
I got paid.
Like premiering next week.
Cha-ching.
Rated R.
5 stars.
All right, well, let's move on. Bob is going to tell us why superconductors don't conduct supercurrents.
Well, superconductors. We've talked about it a bit on the show, haven't we? Never really, I think we went into too much detail. But you guys remember in the late 80s, don't you, when superconductors kind of like reached a mass public consciousness? This is even before, this is really before the internet.
Yeah.
And it was everywhere, everywhere. Everybody was talking about it for a while there. Rebecca, I think you might have been in utero at that time, or possibly a little post utero.
What year was this?
I don't think you mid 80s.
I was post utero.
I know. Yeah, you were post. I know you were post. But it was this huge, breakthrough.
That's what we call AR after Rebecca.
Yes.
So the year 5 AR would be 1985.
But if you guys remember all the hype, it was going to lead to magnetically levitated trains all over the place and
cool.
and little, you know, superconducting wire that you can get at Home Depot and stuff. And everyone was talking about, you know, very soon all these changes were going to come around.
Yeah, where's my maglev, Bob?
Yeah, it was totally rad.
Time,
Bob.
Totally I blame you for the fact that I don't have a maglev.
I'm working on it. But Time Magazine called it a discovery that could change the world. I mean, that's the kind of level of things they were talking about back then.
Yeah.
And you guys remember that iconic image of this, you know, the little magnet floating in the air, suspended above the superconductor? Superconductors, if you're unaware, they're just materials that allow electricity to flow unimpeded through them. So there's no resistance. The electrons just flow. There's no resistance. There's no heat being generated. No inefficiency. So, I mean, theoretically, if you had like a circular spool of superconductor, you could conceivably contain the flow of electricity indefinitely, right? It would just keep going around and around and around,
kind
of like
energy.
Right? So, yeah. Well, you got to put it in there first of all, and this is assuming that there's no energy required to keep it superconducting. If it was room temperature, that would be different. But typically, you'd have to cool these things.
Well, it's room temperature if you live on Pluto,
right?
Yeah, there you go.
Some cold rooms. Now, before the 80s, superconductors were always, they were like metallic, you know, they were all made out of some type of metallic element, and they all required, you know, like, very expensive and difficult to handle helium to supercool it, because it's got to be chilled down to like 10 or 20 degrees Kelvin, extremely cold temperatures in order to get the metal to superconduct.
By the way, Bob, we've been informed several times that it's 10 or 20 Kelvin, not degrees Kelvin.
Did I say degrees?
Please don't make us get more of those letters.
Okay. I just saved us 20 emails. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you.
Every time we get one of those emails, God kills a kitten. Jay masturbates.
The success of our podcast is measured by how many emails we prevent from being corrected emails.
In the 80s was like the decade pretty much for superconductors. Three things really happened that really just completely flipped it around. First off, in 1980, some scientists theorized that, and then they proved that you could actually have organic or carbon-based superconductors. And they actually made one. They actually made an organic superconductor. Now, they got it to superconduct at 1.2 Kelvin, which is very, very low. I mean, it's lower than back then. The record was, I think, 17 Kelvin. So it was very cold, but it doesn't matter. The temperature didn't matter because it was a proof of concept that, you know, you can make these designer molecules for specific tasks. And then the second big thing in the 80s was in 1986. Arguably, probably the biggest thing was that a ceramic superconductor that broke the record. The record used to be 17 Kelvin. They got it up to 30 Kelvin, or even arguably up to 58 Kelvin, which really got everybody, it turned all the scientists' heads like, oh my God, you know, a non-metal superconductor that's at 30 or 58 Kelvin. That was such a huge thing. Although it was still, I think, pretty much below the public's radar at that point. But ceramics were just so odd. You know, ceramics are insulators. How could a ceramic be, a conductor, let alone a superconductor? Everybody was really amazed about it. And these guys actually won, I think, one of the fastest Nobel Prizes in history. It's like a year later, these guys got a Nobel Prize for this. So it was pretty, pretty heady time. And then about a year later, in 87, this is what I was referring to earlier about the new is just going crazy. They changed the ceramic recipe a little bit, and they produced a superconductor that went to 92 Kelvin. Now that's still pretty darn cold, but it was the highest temperature by far. And the main part of that though was that you no longer needed helium or these expensive coolants in order to use it. You could just use liquid nitrogen, right? Liquid nitrogen is really cheap. I remember back then, Steve, you probably remember. Back then they were saying, oh, liquid nitrogen is less expensive than milk.
Yeah.
So this is what made it really a worldwide event, because now it could turn into this amazing tool that that anybody could produce and even, you know, and use cheap liquid nitrogen, although with milk prices today, I don't think they can use that comparison anymore. That's the 80s. Everybody was predicting pie in the sky. Everything was going to be great. But that's 25 years ago, and after all that time, 100,000 scientific papers, I can't buy a superconductor, really. What happened? What went wrong? And one of the biggest problems is that ceramic-based superconductors have a big problem with the current capacity. They just can't carry a high enough current to really make them worthwhile. And now for the first time, scientists are finally really getting a handle on why these things aren't producing like everybody was predicting. And the problem apparently lies in what's called these grain boundaries. If you imagine the ceramic atomic structure, you've got all these rows of atoms in the ceramic wire, say, but they're not all lining up precisely. You know, some of them are kind of like, they're like off. They're not these nice straight lines. They compared it to a piece of graph paper. If you put one piece of graph paper on another and you offset it a little bit, it's just not lined up precisely. And what happens is that where these rows of atoms intersect, you've got a buildup of these lumps of electrical charge, and it's these lumps of electrical charge that they act like speed bumps or barriers that prevent the superconductor from reaching their potential. So that's pretty much the whole problem in a nutshell, and these guys really have really drilled down to really explain this thing mathematically. One of the researchers, Peter Hirschfeld, said that nobody understood why this effect was so strong or why the current was so limited by these grain boundaries, and now they really kind of have a handle on it. And that's all good and everything, but the thing is, though, even though they have this new insight as to what's really going on, this new insight doesn't offer any help. You know, how do you deal with this? And they still don't have any of these answers. And to me, it seems pretty simple. You just got to learn to make ceramic wire with no grain barriers. I guess that's a really difficult problem. But if there were no grain barriers, then this problem would kind of disappear. So hopefully they'll be able to figure that out. I mean, material science is improving so quickly these days. Self-assembly, who knows how they might figure out how to create these. And maybe that's what they need to do, really just minimize these grain barriers as much as they can.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it's an incredibly difficult prospect, because that's pretty – seems like a pretty – easy solution to me, but I'm sure it's much more difficult than that.
It's a non-trivial engineering problem.
Right, and maybe they need to get away from ceramics. You know, I'm hoping there's other classes of materials out there that are also superconducting. And Steve, remember, everybody was talking about, wow, such a big increase, it's such a hot temperature, it's just a matter of time before they have these room temperature superconductors. And I haven't heard anything about them. Nobody's really talking about room temperature superconductors. So
Well, this story perfectly represents what I often bring up. I know I come off as sort of the naysayer in terms of future technology compared to like Bob or Jay, but this is exactly what happens. You have a couple of years of exciting breakthroughs because somebody hits upon some new way of doing something. And then, you know, everyone goes crazy and extrapolates linearly or whatever into the future, saying, oh, you know, in 5-10 years, we're going to have room temperature superconductors and maglevs and blah, blah, blah. But then after this amazing breakthrough, they hit a roadblock and 20 years, nothing, right? You just can't predict that. That's what, you know, technological advances are not on any particular curve or something. Now, if you average them all out, if you average out all the thousands of things that are happening technologically, I'm sure you get to some kind of average rate of advance and whatnot. But on any particular technological problem, it's, you know, peaks and plateaus, you know, and you just can't predict what's going to move us off a plateau into a new way of doing things.
Or outright setbacks, yeah.
Right. Yeah, like with the retroviral therapy, for example, you know, one kid with fatal meningitis, and that the whole research paradigm is shot to hell. So let that be a lesson to you, Bob.
Damn it.
Yeah, Bob. Going against the grain.
Bob, do you think we'll have room temperature superconductors in 2050?
2050?
40 years from now?
And you just got to make some AI first, and then we'll be and let the AI figure it out.
Okay.
That's all.
According to a recent poll, 40% of Americans believe that Jesus Christ will return to Earth by 2050.
Mm-hmm. What's significant about 2050?
Just a nice number, round number.
The poll, it's a round number. The number of the pollsters pulled out of thin air.
I would have gone with 2012.
No, it's interesting because that was the headline as it read in telegraph.co.uk. Very interesting article, which alluded to this Pew Research Center poll in which they asked, amongst the Jesus question, a lot of other questions. Some of the more interesting ones from that poll were that 81% of people believe computers will be able to converse like humans by 2050.
I don't know. What do you think?
I say yes, definitely.
I say no.
Converse?
I say maybe.
Are you talking Turing test level? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, I suppose. I mean,
or converse realistically.
They don't go into finer details about how these questions were asked or formulated, for that matter. They're pretty basic. They're pretty straightforward. I would think that when asked the question of the respondents believe that conversing like humans, like talking to your computer, like, hi, Joey Computer, how are you?
And the Joey Computer.
Oh, man, my hard drive is killing me today. Right?
Oh, God.
Like, literally
Evan,
being able to talk to your computer as if
they're
it's
not going
to
have
person.
Hard drives in 2050. They'll have optical drives. Come on, man.
Well, you know. Hey, they didn't ask me.
They'll have quantum drives, Shay. Get with the program. Well, I think
nano drives.
I think the hardware will probably be up to it. The question is, will we really have mastered the software to have realistic human-like conversation that passes some kind of Turing test?
I don't know. People are getting stupider, I think. So I think that's what's going to happen. It's not that the computer is going to get smarter. People are going to get stupider, and then it's going to be like, well, it's just saying lol over and over and over again and showing me pictures of cats. I think that this is a human. Yeah.
But don't you think people underestimate the complexity of the human brain?
Yeah.
And really.
Oh, absolutely.
And of language. Language is hugely complicated.
Indeed. You just read into it just a little bit. I mean, I certainly don't understand it myself, but just from poking around I did today, wow, there's a lot of things going on when it just comes to having a conversation.
But guys, we're talking 40 years from now. Almost 40 years. That's a long way off.
Yeah, but the thing is, Jay, 40 years ago in, you know, 1970, if you ask people in 40 years, will computers be able to converse like humans? And they would have said yes. Remember 2001, we thought it was perfectly reasonable that you had HAL, a completely realistic personality computer, human persona computer. So I think it's one of those things that we just don't know.
Another statistic, or another poll, I should say, 58% of respondents believed another world war would have occurred by 2050. 71% believe cancer will be cured by 2050.
See, I say no to that.
That's how, you see, that's like saying
I buy that
infections will be cured by 2050. It's way too broad. I mean, really, cancer is part of the human condition.
It's a flawed question because cancer is not one disease. It's many diseases, as I know we've said. And I also know I've said before that I don't think we're going to have this one big cure for all of cancer. And I don't think that we're going to have all cancers cured in 40 years. I think that cancer survivals will continue to increase. I think many individual cancers will be cured, but having a cure for every different type of cancer, nope.
But that won't stop Kevin Trudeau from coming out with a book on it.
Right.
Right, which probably is contributing to the reason why 71% of people believe it.
Yeah, you know, the other 29% were just like, what are you talking about? We've already cured it.
Yeah.
It's just some oranges and a coconut.
Where have you been? Yeah. Bob, you might like this one. Of those polled, 66% of them believe that artificial limbs will perform better than natural ones.
They already do. Huh. Look at that guy that races, that guy that does like the 100-meter dash or whatever, and he's like crazy fast because he has those like flipper legs. They're amazing.
But didn't they reverse their position on their stance that it was an advantage? I remember everyone was saying, yeah, that he has an advantage, a real advantage, and it's not fair. But then a while later, they kind of just did a flip-flop and said, oh, no, he really doesn't. Didn't they do that? They reversed
their whole idea.
But that's like saying if you have a hook for a hand, that's an advantage if you're a longshoreman.
I would say that's correct.
Arr,
yay. Also an advantage in picking up the ladies.
That's right.
But I think what people are imagining is like a bionic arm. You know what I mean? That's
right.
Multi-purpose.
Like a Luke Skywalker type.
Yeah.
Right.
I think that's what they're thinking about with that.
Yeah, but Luke's hand didn't have any special powers.
No.
Well, not that we know of.
Well, yeah, I mean, you didn't see him stick it down his pants right after they...
Well, it might have been stronger than an organic hand.
How could the hand be stronger? It's not. There's no real mechanism to support it.
What are you talking about? It's like metal and stuff.
It depends on how they anchored.
Too? Yeah, his forearm was fake, too.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Mm. Yes.
The whole wrist assembly.
So he could at least, like, he could crush things in his palm.
Yeah, that would be cool.
He could, like, grab a kid's basketball and then squish it to teach them a lesson and then throw it back at them.
Yeah, Jay, he had Kung Fu grip. Just like G.I. Joe.
All right, you got me on that one.
He had the force. He didn't need any extra strength.
That's true.
Last one. 31% of those polled believe the Earth will be struck by an asteroid by 2050. Now, that's a
30% asteroid.
Well, yeah, an that's
asteroid.
A poorly worded question.
Yeah, but how big? To what magnitude?
Exactly.
We could blame Phil Plait for that question.
Yeah, I can't really assume these things. However, I would think that people who were asked that question think asteroid like a global killer.
Yeah.
Asteroid.
Really? A third of people think we're going to be wiped out by an asteroid within the next 40 years?
Yeah, 40
less
years?
Than a third, yeah.
That's crazy. Come on.
That's crazy talk.
No, just look at the odds. The odds of a extinction level event within 40 years is pretty damn.
Yeah, it's pretty
so
low.
So if we get wiped out within the next 40 years from that type of event, then when would we have the time to cure cancer?
Exactly.
Or maybe we'll be able to use our bionic feet to do something with cancer. Surely something.
Kick it in the ass.
one more quick news item. We've been following efforts in the UK to put the squeeze on homeopathy, and now the British Medical Association is recommending that there be a ban on the National Health Service, the NHS, paying for providing any homeopathic treatment.
Yay.
Yay.
Oh, some sanity, finally, after all these years of work.
So they're really hammering homeopathy over there. We got to hand to those guys. So they say
that
they shouldn't allow junior doctors to train in homeopathic hospitals because it goes against the principles of evidence-based medicine. They say that pharmacies that sell homeopathic remedies should label them as placebos. They should be not as medicine.
Wow.
And that the NHS should not be paying a dime for homeopathy.
Well, this is all very strong and very positive and very encouraging.
Somebody pinch me.
I was just in Copenhagen for the Atheist Conference with James Randi, and the organizers sent me an email asking for a favor because they needed some homeopathic pills for Randi because he was going to do an overdose. And they couldn't find any there, which I thought was pretty great.
Yeah.
And so I decided that I would just go to Boots, which is the large pharmaceutical chain here. And they're the ones who have come under fire over the past few months from skeptics and doctors alike for selling homeopathic remedies with their names on it, with their brand name on it. And I could not find any homeopathic sleeping pills that were Boots brand anywhere. I stopped one of the employees and he said, "Excuse me, I'm looking for the sleeping pills that don't do absolutely anything." And she shrugged her shoulders, said they don't sell them anymore. So I'm not sure if it's just my local one or that's
worked.
Been a but I get the feeling that they're pulling back. I think the bad publicity is getting to them. At least I hope.
Excellent.
That's
what did Randy do for his demonstration?
Oh, well, luckily, I guess, luckily, Sid was able to stop by another lesser-known pharmacy near his workplace, and he found some. But not at Boots, the big one. So we were still able to get some, sadly. But
right, so that's progress. It was hard to find them. That's something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Evan, it's time for you to get us up to date on Who's That Noisy. We skipped a week, so...
We did. So I was going to suggest we go back in the time machine 2 weeks instead of 1 week.
Yeah, 2 weeks. What did you play 2 weeks ago?
From 2 weeks ago, here was Who's That Noisy.
Does the CIA give you the authority you need to take dangerous products off the shelf? And the answer is always yes.
I couldn't even tell what he was saying.
He was saying, does Deshaies give you the authority to take dangerous products off the shelf? And the answer is Deshaies, the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994. And the answer is always yes, at least according to this guy. Who is?
Tom Harkin. Thomas Richard Harkin, Junior United States Senator from Iowa, member of the Democratic Party.
Never heard of him.
And yeah, he's never heard of Tom Harkin?
I live in England now. I know about MPs. I don't know about your senators.
I remember that old system that we rebelled against 230 years ago or so.
No, you rebelled against a king. Don't make me bust out history lessons.
There was you guys had a parliament back 230 years
absolutely
ago.
Absolutely you did.
That's not what you were rebelling against. You were rebelling against the king and the fact
he
that
was
you
just
didn't have representation in the parliament.
Right.
This, I thought we'd get more correct answers than we actually did, but someone did guess who's that noisy, and it was...
And who was it?
Kent. He did not offer a last name. He sent in an email. Kent, last name blank.
Superman?
Yeah, Clark. We'll call him Kent Clark, who Kent correctly
blank.
Identified Tom Harkin. Well done, Kent. Very good job.
Great. What do you got for this week, Evan?
And now, for this week's Who's That Noisy?
It's a biological cash register.
It's the first computer to pass the chipmunk test.
They did that in
the 60s. It's a space probe. Evan, it's a space probe.
Tiny R2-D2.
No. Oh, they're all good guesses. I'll give you that. But
CBPO.
Sound like V'ger. V'ger.
V'ger. I predict that someone, at least one person, will get this correct. So be the first one. Send an email. Get on the message board. Let us know who's that noisy.
All right. Thank you, Evan.
Thank you.
We have time for a couple of quick emails, or one quick and one not so quick. The first one is actually just some feedback also from a couple of weeks ago. We had a few people point out that we were a little off in our discussion of the relationship between the distance of a satellite from its planet or the body around which it's orbiting and its orbital period. Bob, you want to straighten us out?
No. That wasn't the problem.
Do it anyway.
Bob, straighten us out.
Well, no, the problem was that somebody who sounded suspiciously like me or Jay made a comment that an object in a similar orbit to the Earth, same distance from the sun, I was wrong. I said that it couldn't stay in the same orbit if it was a different mass, but mass is irrelevant to the orbit.
Yeah, because it factors out of the equation.
Yeah, it just drops out. So there's that.
Yeah, so essentially two objects of any size, the same distance from the sun, would have the same orbital period. But the reason we were talking about, like, just parking an asteroid next to the Earth, the reason why that wouldn't work is because the Earth's gravity would come into play.
Right. Yeah, that would mess up the whole thing. So.
Right. And then, that's why we followed up with the discussion of the Lagrangian points, where you have these gravitational minimums between the fields of the Earth and the Sun, and things would stay put if they were put at one of the five Lagrangian points.
I just want to say that if I had been here, that never would have happened.
Yeah, right. Well, let's go on. Let's do one full email. This one comes from Andy Weidert, and Andy writes, "Hey, Rogues, I've recently had several friends send me articles about sunscreen ineffectiveness and potential harm. Now that we're starting the summer season, I thought it would be an interesting topic to discuss on the show. Also, it would be totally cool if you would mention our local skeptics group." I don't have time for that.
No way.
They have, let's see, skeptics.madisonwi.us. We have an active science in the pub group as well, madsciencepub.org. Finally, I was wondering if you had any favorite skeptically themed songs. I know you've featured Tim Minchin, Graydon Square, and Symphony of Science on the show, but what other songs or artists would you add to create the ultimate skeptical playlist?
Some of
my favorites are Superstition by Stevie Wonder, Cosmic Debris by Frank Zappa, and Pods and Gods by NOFX. Anyway, I love the show, and I've been a listener since 2005. You're partially to blame for inspiring my wife and I to name our son Darwin. Oh, cool. Darwin
awesome.
Weider. Yeah. He was born in Harrisburg, PA during the intelligent design debate. Keep up the great work.
Cool.
All right, so sunscreen. It is the summer season in the northern hemisphere.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of information and misinformation available.
Hemisphere A, as I prefer to call it.
Yes, Hemisphere A. About sunscreens. This is one of those deceptively complex topics where the more you dig, the more complexity you find. Like, really? Sunscreens are this complicated?
But, I know.
So here's – I'll try to give you the skinny on this. The questions are, do sunscreens work and are they safe? And the link that Andy provides is to a report by – the Environmental Working Group. Now, this group, as far as I could tell, the Environmental Working Group, while they seem to do some reasonable scientific review, they also seem to have a very anti-industry political slant and a very low threshold for declaring something risky, not in line with the consensus opinion of medical groups and other independent groups. So they're definitely at one end of the spectrum. So reading their report on sunscreens, it seemed very, very slanted to me and didn't really put things into what I considered to be a full perspective. Other information I thought did a far better job of putting things into a better perspective, including reports by the CDC, the FDA, and as well there was Scott Gavura wrote actually a very nice summary on science-based medicine that I thought was actually much better than the EWG report. So there are different kinds of sunscreen. They essentially block the two types of UV light, UVA and UVB. UVB light is the kind that causes sunburns, and the easy way to remember that is UVB stands for burns. UVA light doesn't cause a sunburn, but it does cause tanning. It penetrates the skin deeper, but also causes the aging of skin. Both types increase the risk of skin cancer. So does blocking, wearing a sunscreen or a sunblock, you know, that blocks out UVA and UVB, does it decrease the risk of sun cancer? It makes sense that it would. Well, it depends on what kind of skin cancer you're talking about. The two most common types of skin cancer, basal cell carcinoma and squamous cell carcinoma, are caused by sun exposure and the risk of these are decreased by wearing sunscreen. However, these are rarely fatal types of skin cancer. The less common type of skin cancer, melanoma, is responsible for most of, like 75% of skin cancer deaths, but it's not really clear what the relationship is between sun exposure and the risk of melanoma. Some lines of evidence seem to support a link, for example, intermittent sun exposure increases the risk of melanoma. There appears to be a dose-response relationship, but other evidence suggests that perhaps chronic sun exposure may decrease the risk of melanoma, perhaps because of production of vitamin D, which is the other wrinkle in all this, is that we need sun exposure to increase our vitamin D levels. So there the relationship is not as clear. There's also the question of, do sunblocks work in other ways? Now, again, here's where the Environmental Working Group was a little deceptive in, you know, quoting the FDA as saying that sunscreen alone is not effective, but that's not what they were saying. If you read the actual FDA report that they're even linking to, the FDA recommends that you use sunscreen. But here's the wrinkle. We were talking before, Rebecca, about people thinking when a risk sort of falls below the radar, the risky behaviors just come right back. Related to that is the notion that people get a false sense of security and it actually increased their risk. So people are at higher risk when they are driving in SUVs because they have a false sense of security, you know, for example. And here that applies to sunscreen as well. When people wear sunscreen, they actually increase their sun exposure more than the protection they're getting from the sunscreen.
Holy crap.
What the FDA recommends is that it's part of a comprehensive approach of limiting sun exposure, wearing hats, wearing clothing, seeking shade, and using sunscreen. But they
and using it properly, really, because I think a lot of people don't know how to properly use sunscreen. They don't realize, you know, that they tend to rub it in, and, you know, so that there's no white at all on their skin when, you know, that particular kind of sunscreen needs to show on your skin. Or they go into the water and it all washes off and they don't reapply.
Yeah.
They just don't think about it.
Exactly. So most of the time, sunscreen is used improperly. Talking about the organic sunscreens, the ones that are clear when you apply them to the skin, studies showed that if you have, for example, a SPF, it's a sunburn protective factor, which only relates to the amount of UVB protection, people are applying an SPF 15. The way it's commonly used, it only provides an SPF 2. SPF 50, only an SPF 2.6, as most people apply it. So you have to put on a lot more than people think that they do, and they really have to slather it on, and you say put it on before there's sun exposure and reapply it every couple hours or after getting out of the water. And in essence, you really do need to limit your sun exposure in addition to using this. And sunscreens are really effective. They're most effective, in fact, for unavoidable sun exposure. So if you're working or whatever where you can't avoid the sun and you're using it to minimize your sun exposure, then it's a pure advantage. But if you're using it in order to spend more time in the sun, it's actually a net disadvantage because of that, especially because people don't use it properly. But there are two kinds of sun barriers. Now, the ones that look white are the inorganic barriers, zinc oxide, titanium dioxide. They're actually the perfect sunscreens because they block both UVA and UVB. They are photostable. They don't break down in the light, and they have really good near-perfect blockage. The one downside is that they are aesthetically unappealing because you have this white, greasy, opaque material that covers your skin.
I look best when I'm white and greasy and opaque.
Yeah. So most people go for the organic barriers that they don't physically block the UV light, but they either absorb it or convert it to heat or they filter it out. And these are the ones that most people, you know, use inappropriately. So the UV protection works when used properly, but don't get a false sense of security from them. And the organic ones also, they may break down over time in addition to being washed off. So again, you have to reapply them. They do protect against the most common, but the less fatal forms of skin cancer. It's not as clear with the melanoma. But now the EWG and others have raised concerns about harmful ingredients in sunscreens. And here we get to the same story that I see over and over again. Part of it comes down to the difference between hazard and risk. A hazard essentially is when you say there is biological evidence of a potential negative effect of this substance. Risk means in the exposures that we're talking about, what's the statistical increased risk of developing some negative outcome, some disease or some harm. So the Environmental Working Group really is just focusing on hazard. I mean, they will take any tenuous, small, preliminary animal study showing some toxicity and say, that's unacceptable. That's the industry trying to kill you, and the government's totally failing to protect you from it. I mean, really, that's how they present these issues. Whereas if you look at the overall evidence, epidemiological and clinical evidence, et cetera, and you ask what's the real risk here, it's either really small or we just don't know. It's so small that it hasn't been detected. And then you can argue about, well, is there currently enough evidence? Have we really, you know, minimized the potential risk enough? And that's where the real legitimate controversy is over some of these substances. So the two that come up the most, one is retinyl palmitate, which is actually a photosensitizer. It's a type of vitamin A that will increase your sensitivity to light. And the study that the EWG quotes to say that it's unsafe was a study in mice. But in this study, the retinyl palmitate was applied by itself to the mice who were then exposed to sunlight. Yes, it's a photosensitizer. So they had an increased risk of skin damage and skin cancer with it. But that doesn't necessarily tell us anything about the risk of retinyl palmitate in sunscreen. You understand the difference? They did it just by itself on mice versus in sunscreen, which would block the very UV rays that are putting you at risk. So I don't think those two things are comparable.
They remind me, the environmental working group who did this study, what have you, report, I guess. It immediately reminded me of the campaign for safe cosmetics, which made a big splash 2 years ago, I think, when they quote unquote discovered high amounts of lead in lipstick. But what they were really doing was mostly warping statistics in order to fit in with their agenda and then blowing it out of proportion. When in fact the lead levels were still remarkably low, completely trace and completely harmless to the people who are using them. But if you go to their website, they're still campaigning for the government to crack down on cosmetics for that.
Right.
And so I checked and I saw that they're actually, coalition partners. So I'm not surprised. It seems like it's unfortunate really, because I think that we need these consumer protection groups because, for instance, when it comes to cosmetics, they really aren't well regulated in many instances. They do need stricter regulations, but it doesn't really do anyone any good when these groups are blowing things out of proportion and taking, you know, like you said, Steve, small animal studies and extrapolating them to large populations of humans.
Right.
It just does no one any good.
Yeah, and they confuse hazard and risk. And for balance, the thing is, it's interesting what I'm finding when I look into these issues is that there are industry front groups that are trying to minimize the risk and play down any risks. And then there are these either environmental or political groups that are anti-industry in their ideology that are playing up the tiniest risks. Both are distorting the evidence one way or the other. And it's really frustrating. Whereas, you know, there's some place in the middle where we're considering risk seriously, we're keeping industry honest and regulating them in terms of the safety of their products, but we're putting it in context. You know, there's risk to not using sunscreen properly. There's risk of too much sun exposure. It's not just melanoma. And that's the other thing that's really deceptive. Oh, sunscreen doesn't protect you against the most fatal form of skin cancer, therefore it doesn't work. Well, no, it prevents sunburn, it prevents photoaging, it prevents other forms of skin cancer. Even if they're not fatal, they could be very disfiguring if you have to have them removed. But just don't let it give you a false sense of security. You need the full kind of picture with some kind of balance. But that's what you don't get from these ideological groups.
Yeah, and in this case, this campaign can be very dangerous if it encourages more people to throw away their sunscreen and still go out in the sun.
I hate to say it, but it's similar. It's reminiscent in my mind to the anti-vaccine movement in that they're focusing on little risks without putting the whole thing into context. It's very pro-environment, anti-industry, anti-government, and distrustful. It's very politically very similar.
Yeah.
Not as bad. I'm not putting it in the same ballpark. We're just saying that there is some similarity in approach and ideology. The other constituent of sunscreen that comes up is oxybenzone. And it does provide some UVB protection and some UVA protection. It's fairly photostable, so it doesn't break down, which is good. And again, the EWG, the Environmental Working Group, and a lot of other websites were making a lot of hay over a CDC study which showed that 97% of the people they tested had oxybenzone in their urine. So basically saying it's getting absorbed, it's getting into your body, that's why it's showing up into the urine. They say it's a potential hormone disruptor. But again, if you look at the actual evidence, the evidence shows – we're not, you know, no significant risk from this. But again, you could, maybe you can make a legitimate argument that it needs to be further studied. So I think that's appropriate. But saying don't go anywhere near anything with oxybenzone, that's a little, that seems a little excessive. And actually, the fact that it's in 97% of people's urine, that's because it's not just in sunscreen. It's in like many cosmetics and lots of other things as well. That's why it's so common. But I also was reading some studies when I was researching this. There was one group that developed a technology where they take the oxybenzone and they put it in like little beads. So you get all of the benefits of it because it's absorbing the UV light, but it's not getting absorbed by the skin. So that may be a good approach to take in terms of sunscreen technology.
Interesting.
Steve, two small points, Steve. The SPF number itself, I used to think, and it took me a while to get over this, but I used to think the bigger the number, the better. Higher, higher, higher. But really, once you get above, I think, SPF 50, it's really diminishing returns. I mean, the difference between SPF 50 and SPF 90, which I have downstairs right now, and SPF 90, I'm like, oh, it's 90. But it's such a minuscule difference.
Bob, what
it's
is it,
so, it's so tiny that it's really – and that could also foster that sense of security. Like, oh, it's 90. I could stay out here all day.
Yeah, the numbers get misleading because as they build up – if you look at the percentage of UVB radiation getting through to the skin, so at SPF 15 allows 7% through, SPF 30 allows 4% through, and SPF 60 allows 2% through. So you get to diminishing returns, but the number can grow to be really, really big. And you might think that, ooh, SPF 100, that's 10 times better than SPF 10, but it actually isn't. It's only marginally better in terms of the amount of UVB that you're getting exposed to.
Yeah.
Well, let's go on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Is everyone ready for this week?
Do it.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Si, senor.
All right, here we go. Item number one. A recent survey shows that only 8% of Americans correctly identified the summer as the most dangerous driving season.
That's not fair. Evan just read all those surveys.
Item number two. The Saturn Cassini probe has recently confirmed the existence of small rings around the moon Rhea. And item number three. A new study shows that learning from online lectures is inferior to learning from their live counterparts. And Rebecca gets to go first because she whined.
What? No. I haven't actually read any of these. It puts me at a distinct disadvantage.
That's true. You have to actually reason them through.
Okay. 8% of Americans correctly identified the summer as the most dangerous driving season. If there are a few assumptions in that statement that could be fictional. For instance, it might not be a recent survey, or it might be a larger percentage, or it might not be correct that summer is the most dangerous driving season. Why would summer be the most dangerous driving season? Wouldn't it be winter when there's snow and ice? That's dangerous. Maybe more people are drinking outside during the summer and then drive home or something. But that's silly. I think winter is the most dangerous driving season, speaking personally. Item number two is that the Cassini probe confirmed the existence of small rings around the moon Rhea. Rings around a moon, that's really weird because wouldn't Saturn be so large that it would interfere with any rings forming around a satellite moon? So that doesn't seem very plausible either. And the third one is that learning from online lectures is inferior to learning from live lectures. That one makes total sense because online lectures, it's much more difficult to pay attention because you've got your computer there and it's full of porn and music and movies, as opposed to a lecture where it's just your droning professor. So that's the only one that makes sense to me. And so I'm going to say that one's the fiction because the other two seem just silly and you probably threw them in there to throw me off. But you didn't expect that I would zig when you thought I would zag, did you, Steve? Did you?
All right, Jay.
What? No answer. Oh,
he thought that was a rhetorical question.
No. I wanted an answer.
the summer as the most dangerous driving season. So is this science or fiction question about whether or not I believe that 8% of Americans said that, or about what they claimed? You follow me?
Yeah, well, yeah. I said that earlier.
Yeah. I mean, I'll give you that. If any component of that is wrong, then the whole thing must be fiction.
Well, how the hell am I supposed to know if 8% of Americans said that?
You ask them.
I can't reason my way through that. I don't know.
You could take a quick survey right now and extrapolate.
Okay. Steve?
I think it's winter.
Do you think that summer's the most dangerous driving season?
I think it's smarch myself.
That's not a season. That's
lousy smarch weather.
The Saturn Cassini probe has recently confirmed the existence of small rings around the moon, Rhea. That's interesting. I have no idea.
It's R-H-E-A. Is that Rhea or Rhea?
Right.
I have a friend with that Rhea. Last name spelled that way, and it's Rhea.
Your friend is wrong.
Anyway, new study shows that learning from online lectures is inferior to learning from their live counterparts. I would agree with that. I've listened to online lectures, and I've been in online lectures, and I'm much more engaged when I'm in the room that the lecture is taking place. Wow, this is a really... Damn, Steve. I'm stumped. I'm going to say that the summer thing is the fiction.
Okay, Evan.
All right, item one. The inside of Jay's knee looks like chicken. I believe that is true. Oh, wait.
That's a fact.
That was the discussion.
Raw chicken, I said, Evan. Raw chicken.
Oh, then it's fiction. Okay, 8% of Americans correctly identified summer as the most dangerous driving season. I think it has to do with quantity. The quantity of driving goes way up in the summer. That is a pretty well-established fact, I believe. And therefore, perhaps based on the quantity of drivers, it must become the most dangerous driving season based on quantity. So I believe that one is correct. The Cassini probe. Now, this is very, very cool. And I don't know. Do we have any examples in the solar system of rings around moons? Would this be the first? I know I can't think of any. I know several of the outer planets have rings, but the moon itself, I'm tending to think that that one is correct, which leaves this new study showing that learning from online lectures is inferior. You know, that's a little tricky because inferior, how inferior is just a little inferior, a lot inferior? And I'm not buying that one. I think that one's going to pan out to be correct, that online learning will be roughly the same as live. And I think we have a lot more evidence nowadays and data to support that, because online learning has become, you know, commonplace, whereas certainly many years ago it was more the exception. I think that one is fiction.
Okay, Bob.
8% of Americans correctly identifying the summer. I do believe summer is the most dangerous time of driving. And I think a lot of Evan and Rebecca, I think you pretty much hit on it. There's a lot more people driving in summertime, and there's also a lot of drinking going on, holidays, July 4th, and so on. So that makes sense that the summer is the most dangerous. And I think everybody just assumes that it's winter, so it doesn't surprise me. And I'm sure there's some weirdos that said spring and fall were the worst. So yeah, I can kind of see 8%. It seems a little low, but I could go with that.
Weirdos?
Oh, I don't know. Outliers.
Okay, that's better.
I'm going to go to 3. Yeah, that just – it makes a lot of sense, and Rebecca had a good point. It just makes the most sense, and sometimes Steve will – you never know what Steve's going to do with it, though.
I do.
He might have expected you to zig.
No.
So he might be
Steve
anticipating that, so we shall see.
The zig coming.
The second one, though, this – I mean, I read so many goddamn science news today. There's no way I would have missed this one. This one, that's big. It rings around a moon. So I'm going to pull that card. I'm going to pull the card that I would have seen it if it was true, if it were true. And also confirmed. I've never even heard any theories that would need to be confirmed or even low-resolution sightings. I don't think the moons are – I wouldn't be surprised if there were rings around a moon of Saturn that we really – it's just so far away we really couldn't make it out. I mean, we missed the moons around – the rings around Jupiter for how long until we got close? So I don't think there was anybody was even expecting it or theorizing it in order for it to be confirmed. So I'm gonna go with that one. I'm gonna say that the rings around Rhea or Rhea. I'm gonna say
it's Rhea. I checked. It's Rhea.
Okay.
All right, so you guys are all spread out all over the place, so I guess I'll just take them in order. A recent survey shows that only 8% of Americans correctly identified the summer as the most dangerous driving season, and that one is science. As 4% said spring, 4% said fall, 8% said summer, and the rest said winter. And the winter is incorrect. The summer is the most dangerous driving season. Now, none of you hit upon the reason. The primary
reason.
And I actually gave you the answer earlier in the episode. See if you
can. Actually listen to what you say. Is it because people don't wear sunscreen in their convertibles and they get cancer?
They go blind. They get cataracts.
Or they're shooting whale videos. I think an asteroid's going to impact the Earth. Hang on.
No, they have pertussis and they're coughing while they're driving in the summer.
The whooping cough, right. Oh, and
they get bionic hands and they go crazy while they're driving, like those cars.
Oh, the great aux went extinct.
They hit aux.
Because they have a false sense of security. Because in the winter, they're on alert. They know it's dangerous, so they drive carefully. And in the summer, they think, oh, it's sunny, the road's clear. And
coefficient of friction's good.
I don't know, but Steve, there's no time during my summer driving where my car just careens off the road because of ice and snow. Like that doesn't take place. I've done that in the winter.
Yeah, but and get into an actual accident? People drive faster, so when they do get into an accident, it's much more likely to be fatal. Same reason people are there's more rural accidents on rural highways than on urban highways, because in the rural setting, people have a sense of comfort and false sense of security. Mm. The single most dangerous driving day of the year in the United States. In the United States.
Labor Day.
Memorial Day.
I always heard it was the day after. Wait, no.
4th of July.
Thanksgiving or something?
4th of July. Oh.
4th of July.
Yep.
Hmm. Bob's birthday?
Yep. That's right.
Because everybody's leaving Bob's party drunk.
Oh, no wonder.
Bob, take their keys.
On those rural roads.
Good move.
That's how those aux died.
All right, so that one was science. Let's go on to number two. The Saturn Cassini probe has recently confirmed the existence of small rings around the moon Rhea. Now, I'm going to give you the backstory to this one first before I give you the answer.
What does that mean? Backstory?
So in 2008, a paper was published in Science in which physicist Grant Jones of University College London and colleagues described the fact that there was some unseen solid material around Rhea that was blocking some radiation that they should have been seeing. And they hypothesized at that time that there was an invisible ring around Rhea. It was that when that was absorbing some energetic electrons that were trapped in Saturn's magnetosphere. So, but other astronomers were skeptical. They said that, if there were a ring around Rhea, Saturn would rip it away. It wouldn't be stable. The moon is too small. And because of the configuration, in order to form a ring, something would have to strike Rhea just right. And it's just low probability that it would happen. So the Cassini probe recently has taken a close look at Rhea, and they showed that, did they confirm the existence or did they refute the existence of the rings around Rhea?
Confirmed.
They refuted it. It's fiction. Bob got it right.
So close.
Yay.
So the skeptics were right.
You knew I was going to zig.
I did.
How did you know?
I saw the zig.
So
that was pretty cool. So, if you were aware that this was something that was raised a couple of years ago.
Right. I'm glad I wasn't.
When I saw it, I was like, rings around a moon? Yeah. And Evan, it would have been the first moon with rings. And I think it is just inherently unlikely just due to the gravitational situation. You know, the parent.
I would imagine.
Yeah, planet is just likely to rip it away and just would be too Suck unstable. It'd be very unlikely.
I believe I mentioned that.
Yeah. You did, but you didn't go with that. So that means that a new study shows that learning from online lectures is inferior to learning from their live counterparts is science. And this was the study where they compared the identical lectures. That was sort of the new bit about this study, where they took a lecture that was given live, and they also had pretty much the identical lecture recorded and over the internet, and they also randomized students. So students agreed to participate in the study, and then they randomized them to viewing the lectures either online or live, and the students who went to the live lectures did better in terms of the knowledge that they retained. They didn't really get into too much about what the cause is. The study didn't really provide any direct information about what caused that, but you can speculate, as like Jay was saying, you're more engaged, more likely to pay attention, less distracted, as Rebecca was saying.
Yeah. You know, environment's got to be.
Yeah, so that's all plausible. However, you know, they also point out that this was giving a lecture optimized for a live lecture, right? And then giving it also taped online, as opposed to a lecture that was optimized for online learning. So this doesn't mean necessarily the inferiority of courses that are optimized for online. But of course, what does that mean to be optimized for online? That is something that we're still working out. But it may mean doing
camera angles, explosions, nudity, you know.
Yeah. No, it doesn't. Oh, but seriously, they may require things that are more engaging, that are multimedia, that will hold the attention better, that will take advantage of the things that you can do online, that you can't do in a live lecture, that are more interactive.
Interactive, I would say, would be a big key.
You would think, but you know, I've learned not to make naive assumptions about things like this. So the things that you think might be the most effective may turn out not to be when you actually study it. But, you know, but there's a lot of questions still to be answered with this, and we have a long way to go before, you know, we do answer all these questions about online learning. But you can't take this one study and say, oh, we shouldn't invest in or move material online. It just means that you can't just simplistically copy it online and assume that it's going to do well. All right, good job, Bob. I was hoping to get a clean sweep, man, but you took it from me right at the end. I knew where you were going with it from the beginning. I could tell.
Bob had to repeat himself.
Well, it is his birthday.
I got it last week, didn't I?
It's like fake future birthday.
Happy 58th birthday, Bob. We love you.
58? Holy crap.
All right, Jay, give us a quote for this week.
Here's this week's quote. Science is the attempt to make the cat.
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 That movie.
Science is the attempt to make the chaotic diversity of our sense experience correspond to a logically uniform system of thought.
Who said that?
I will tell you. Albert Einstein!
Yeah! Oh, yeah. Woohoo, he's still alive, isn't he?
Well,
his brain is.
Now, is that the bobblehead Einsteins from the Night at the Museum Smithsonian edition? Or the real Einstein?
Please don't invoke Night at the Museum. The adults are talking, Steve.
You know, I have two kids. My head is filled with all of these movies.
Is that like the thing from Meet the Fockers?
Well, you got a problem with Ben Stiller now. Is that what you're telling
me? Yes. Yes, I do.
I'm really over Ben Stiller, too. I mean,
what's he done for me lately? Nothing. I have an announcement.
Yes.
You're pregnant.
No.
Oh. We go through this every 9 months or so.
We really do. Well, you know, we're going to be at TAM soon.
This is the last episode of TAM.
For those who can't make it to TAM, I will be in Glasgow at Skeptics in the Pub on July 26th.
Glasgow,
Monday.
Scotland?
Yes. So you can, you can probably Google that and figure out where it is and everything. But it's going to be awesome. Woo!
Ugh.
Then again, so is TAM. So.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, we are. After this episode goes up, we are off to TAM. But we will have another episode ready to go up on the Saturday that we're at TAM, and then we'll be recording a live episode while we're there for the following week.
Which you'll hear the following week.
Yes.
Love this time of year.
And the next episode, we have a special guest, a special secret guest that we will reveal in the future. But you will be
that
excited.
We will reveal in the future.
In the year
it will become known to all.
No, we'll reveal it in the past.
Meaning not now.
Oh. Check your Akashic files and find out who next.
But maybe it is now, because maybe it is the future when they're listening to this. Like Bob's birthday is long gone.
When you are listening to this, we will have recorded that episode with the secret special guest rope.
Like that scene in Spaceballs where they rewind the tape.
Yes.
When is
my
now?
Mind is
soon.
Blown.
All right, enough pop culture references. Thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Surely.
See you in TAM.
Yeah, see you guys in Vegas.
See you in Vegas, Rebecca. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.